The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, LIBOR isn't working. Barclays owns up to manipulating a multi-trillion dollar market as chief executive Bob Diamond is forced out. His plea of ignorance has been branded implausible, and rumours abound of a conspiracy involving Whitehall officials and the banks to fiddle key interest rates. Meanwhile, fingers are pointed in a Westminster whodunit as we look into the latest scandal to rock the British establishment. Joining me here in the studio, we have the Observer's economics editor, Heather Stewart, and alongside her are our columnists Seamus Milne and Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Done! For you, big boy. That's how one Barclays trader might tell another that they'd fiddled the London interbank offered rate. And another might reply, come round to mine and we'll open a bottle of Bollinger. All good fun, but the backlash has rocked the financial industry with a series of resignations and sackings, a melee of finger-pointings and mudslinging, and we're only just getting started. The scandal could hit up to 20 more banks, while the Tories are desperate to drag Gordon Brown back into the picture, and Ed Miliband eyes his chance to unleash another Leveson-style inquiry on the government. But what's it all about? Jill Trainor, our city editor and expert on the banks, is here. Jill, can you explain for the uninitiated what it is that these Barclays traders are up to and why anyone should care?
OK, so it's all about the London interbank offered rate and its European equivalent, which is called Euribor. And we shorten London interbank offered rate to LIBOR. LIBOR is a benchmark interest rate that lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of things are priced off. And you can get lots and lots of different LIBOR rates. So you can get a LIBOR rate for just borrowing tonight, or you can get a LIBOR rate for borrowing in 12 months' time. This rate is fixed by 15 big banks in the city who every day get asked a very simple question. At what price do you think your rivals will charge you to borrow at, let's say, 3 months?
So when one bank lends to another?
Yeah. And it's kind of a hypothetical question, because it's not actually asking them what price they did borrow at, but what price they might borrow at. Anyway, now we've got through that, each bank has to submit its rates. And this story is really about these people who were submitting rates and what they were doing. Were they putting in honest prices about what they thought they could borrow at? So hence the references for this one's for you, big boy. It seems that there were some people trying to influence them and saying to them, you wouldn't just put in a bit of a higher bid for me, would you? I need the LIBOR rate to be a bit higher, you know, because I've got some great big deal I need to get through.
And is it right that this is a scandal of two halves? You've got these Bollinger years where it's about these complex derivative bets. They've got an interest rates. And then you've suddenly got in 2008, it's different because people think the banks are going bust.
Yeah, there are kind of two elements to it. So there's this piece from 2005 that sort of also seems to run through to 2009, where this sort of appears to be this sort of blatant attempts to do it. Then there's this harder picture that takes place during the 2008 banking crisis, when the world was in meltdown, the financial markets were barely working, and where there seems to be it's laid out in the FSA document, the Financial Services Authority's document, that they were convinced that Barclays was trying to move rates because it was worried about the publicity it was getting from being seen as one of the higher LIBOR submitters. And the idea is, if your bid is much higher than everybody else's, oh dear me, you must be in deep financial trouble. Now, Barclays weren't, but their bids were higher than everyone else.
I see. So the fear would have been, from Barclays' point of view, that they'd become another Royal Bank of Scotland or whatever and get taken over maybe by the government?
Yeah, that seems definitely to be what Bob Diamond, the former boss of Barclays, it's really hard to say that still, the former boss of Barclays was saying to MPs this week, is that he was trying to say, look, you know, I our big concern was that, you know, we might get nationalised too.
And, of course, that's where it started to bring in some Whitehall and Westminster.
Yeah, this is where it gets complicated. This is where we get the sort of great unknowns. There's this idea that Paul Tucker, deputy governor of the Bank of England, had a phone call with Bob Diamond on the 29th of October 2008, when, I remind you, the markets were in meltdown. Where it's a sort of, you know, you can read this memo any way you like. It's Bob Diamond's note of his conversation with Paul Tucker. And in it, he makes clear that Paul Tucker has told him that some figures in Whitehall are worried about the higher levels that Barclays are putting into the LIBOR system. And Bob Diamond's close lieutenant reads this memo. His name's Jerry Del Maizière. He also quit this week and takes it as a signal from Paul Tucker to reduce the libel submissions.
Jill Trainer, our city editor there. Jill was saying there, Martin, about how the scandal, particularly its 2008 phase, where it's dealing with crisis rather than flattering profits in the good times, has dragged in the Bank of England. And that, of course, is where there's the potential to drag in the politicians, perhaps, as the next step.
Well, I think that's the issue that's underlying this as far as Westminster is concerned. The question is, who talked to Barclays? We know that Paul Tucker of the Bank of England had this conversation, but the memo that Bob Diamond wrote implies what Whitehall officials were involved too. When Bob Diamond was questioned in front of the MPs this week on the Treasury Select Committee, it wasn't entirely clear, at least to me, whether he meant by officials, politicians or civil servants or advisors. You know, he was a bit blurring. He blurred quite a lot of his answers, but that was one that I think needs following up, because the question is, did Treasury political appointees, Paul Miners, Shriti Vadera, possibly the Chancellor, possibly even the Prime Minister Gordon Brown, did Ed Balls, who's sort of never left this field, even though at the time he was not a Treasury Minister, have some engagement with it? So these are the kind of questions which, from the Tory point of view, they would very much like to flush out in this process. But so far, that's been they haven't really managed to do that very much.
Heather, you watched Diamond Bob, didn't you?
All 3 hours of it, yeah.
And Martin there saying that he was deliberately throwing a bit of dust and confusion into the air, perhaps. What do you think his game was?
Well, it's interesting because it wasn't quite as billed. You know, the signals that we had been getting from the city and certainly from the Conservative Party before the hearing were that Diamond was going to turn up and he had nothing to lose because he'd already resigned. And so he was going to kind of drag down these sort of, you know, high profile figures, Paul Tucker and Shriti Vadera, with him. And actually, it really didn't live up to that. He was quite careful to say that what Paul Tucker had been doing, Paul, as he called him, referring to everyone by their first name, what Paul Tucker had been doing was passing on some concerns that Whitehall had, that the LIBOR rate was rather high and that Barclays' rate was rather high. And that in doing so, he thought Tucker was just doing his job. And that you know, it seems that Diamond's overriding concern was, as we talked about earlier, was the idea that just as the Treasury had intervened in RBS, you know, perhaps it might look at these high interest rates that Barclays seemed to be being charged and decide that it needed to rescue the bank in some way, which was the last thing Diamond wanted. He and his then boss, John Varley, were desperate to keep the bank's independence. So if we were hoping for a sort of murky plot to emerge, it didn't really. He didn't name and shame anyone. And as Martin says, to some extent, one came out more confused about the issue than before. He could have said, you know, I took it as a direct instruction from the bank or a direct instruction from the Treasury that I should lower Barclays rates. And that was very much not what he said.
And so, if anything, it sounds like maybe he was trying to give these some puffed up MPs, as he would have seen it, the idea that they're getting their knickers in a twist about something they didn't really understand. And maybe as well, he's trying to remind them that back in that time of 2008, if the government were taking some extraordinary measures like leaning on banks to kind of keep some secret things secret, we need to remember how extraordinary those times were. Do you think that's a reasonable point? I mean,
it certainly was, a very, very strange time. And as I say, you know, the government had to take unprecedented steps to rescue the banking sector. And you know, this was a bank which was very proud of the fact that it was. I mean, he pointed out this conversation took place at a time when Barclays was doing a deal with Middle Eastern investors to bring in a lot of money, which would prevent it having to go to the taxpayer. So, you know, his main aim at that point and his main interest at that point was keeping Barclays out of the hands of the taxpayer. But you know, it was an extraordinary period. And the worry really that politicians had about the LIBOR rate was because, as Jill said, it's used to price a lot of loans right across the economy. So their worry was, you know, if you're sitting in the Treasury, what you're really worried about is the fact that this is a danger signal, which shows that the financial system is not functioning properly.
So, Seamus, capitalism's always a bit of a confidence trick, isn't it? You know, people need to know that, people need to have faith that debts will be paid. Everyone knows that banks don't really have enough money stored in their vaults to pay everyone if they try and get their money out at the same time. Would it be such a bad thing if at the depth of the crisis, the government was trying to persuade bankers to make things look a bit more solid than they really were?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, that discussion diverts attention from the earlier phase of the LIBOR manipulation, which is, you know, which the fines have been paid over, which is when they were trying to manipulate them in the other direction to make money internally in the bank. So there's an argument about that that second bit of manipulation where it was being manipulated in the other direction, but there's no argument about the first. So I think, in a way, from Bob Diamond's point of view, it was quite convenient to be having a discussion about that, and about you know, the necessity to save the banks and the confidence crisis at the time. And of course, he was blaming the other banks for underreporting their effective LIBOR rate. But really, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this was a consistent level of corruption, which was in the public domain 4 years ago, and which no one did anything about until now.
It is striking, isn't it, Martin, that whereas the big scandal that broke in 2008 is there are all these complicated bet derivatives, they're called, no one quite knew how they worked, the bankers assured us they were very clever, and then the trickery blew up in their faces. That was phase one. The difference now is that this isn't anything very clever, it's just old-fashioned skullduggery and lying, isn't it? And that probably does change the public's mood on this a bit.
Yes, I don't really know how much the public is able to follow this. I mean, I think we all find it quite complicated. It's quite difficult to explain to yourself. You have to do quite a lot of reading and to grasp what's going on. And if you looked at the Select Committee hearings yesterday, it was clear that some of the MPs were struggling with the material, as lots of people do. And so, you know, I think how far this goes beyond a kind of general sense that things are not going very well, and that there's skullduggery, and that, you know, they're all in this together in that sense of the term, is hard to know. I mean, I suspect politically, you know, people don't like the bankers, but they don't like politicians either. And so the question of how far politicians are able to kind of occupy the moral high ground on this is a bit uncertain to me.
But I do think in the public's mind, they don't get the intricacies of LIBOR, you know, who does? But I do think it sort of builds up to a picture of a banking sector that isn't working very well.
Totally.
Doesn't have, you know, any moral values at all, which, to be honest, might have been what a lot of people suspected. But, it feeds into the worst, but all those emails addressed to Big Boy and so on, they feed into the worst kind of stereotype of what the banks are up to. And, you know, we've had stories about mis-selling of financial products in the last 12 months. We've had stories about tax avoidance. We've had stories about extraordinary bonuses still being paid, you know, 4 or 5 years into the crisis. And I think it does, there is a kind of broad general picture here of a sector of the economy that isn't working for the public.
I completely agree with that. And I think that what's interesting in British politics and in politics around the world is that parties are still struggling to find the way to put that message across and really make it work as a campaigning tool and as a way of rallying support.
Well, they've spent a very long time sucking up to these people, apart from anything else.
Well, that's true, but equally, right now, all the parties in this country are in the market of trying to bash the bankers effectively for political reasons. So, you know, I mean, it's quite a fluid situation, even though it's a complete reverse of what it was before the financial collapse.
And yet, it's much kind of richer discussion in terms of prognosis than prescription, Seamus. You know, like Heather says, everyone hates the ratings agencies. The bankers now seem to have been peddling porkies. The regulators were gullible. But you just have the sense from Labour as well as the Conservatives that the agenda's kind of, can't we replace capitalism with something nice? It's one of those posters once said. But this week you wrote something in the paper about what you'd see as a totally different banking system.
Well, I think, you know, this is cumulative from 2007-08. We've got the build-up of overwhelming evidence that the private banking system, not just in Britain, but the entire deregulated private banking model that was encouraged and fueled across the Western world over the last 25, 30 years has failed. It's not only been shown to be corrupt, the mis-selling, the tax avoidance, it's also been shown to be utterly incompetent, as we've seen in the last few weeks in the RBS NatWest's complete failure to fulfil its basic banking functions. And of course, it's triggered the greatest economic collapse for 80 years. And so it's clear that model is broken. And I think we're seeing the build-up of political and economic pressures for a change of direction. And, politicians, not just in Britain, are seeking and trying to find the shape and the contours of what that might be. And that's something that's in flux, as Martin was saying, but it's also a matter of political conflict.
But give us a flavour. What would it be, rather than just that we don't like what's there at the moment? What would a new system look like?
Well, I think it's clear that there has to be a much greater public control and presence in the banking sector. There has to be. I mean, we've had a lot of discussion in the last 4 years about the need to separate investment banking from retail banking, and we've got a half-baked proposal for that to happen in some form in Britain by 2019. I think it's clear that a lot of the things that we're talking about now wouldn't have been solved by that, and we need. I think it's there's a build-up of consensus among specialists in this field that there needs to be more far-reaching change. And there's an argument now about whether or not we need to have, a different ecology of banking, different kinds of forms of ownership in the banking sector. We need to have smaller banks. We need to learn from other countries who've had effective banking, public banking models. We need to use the part nationalised banks, RBS and Lloyds. We need to turn them into really effective public sector investment banks to drive recovery and lending for investment and growth in the next phase. And I think, it's hard to imagine a Tory Lib Dem coalition doing that. But I think what we've seen in the last 4 years is that government's prepared to do all sorts of things we didn't expect because of the scale of this crisis and the utter failure of this model. So I think, we will see different forms of the financial sector evolving. But it is a very powerful political lobbying tool, as we've already had reference to. And the politicians have been, to some significant extent, bought by this sector and the private interests that dominate it. I mean, not just the fact that the Tory party is the greater part of its funding comes from banks and the financial sector, in particular part of it. But also, as we saw in the last Labour government, there has been a very significant colonization of Whitehall and politics by finance. And, it's going to be a big battle to turn that round.
I mean, it's very unclear at the moment, Martin, isn't it, who's going to prevail in the coming blame game, which is certainly what all this talk about different forms of inquiries is about.
I think it is difficult, and we may even, within the next few hours, find that there is some form of compromise on this. I mean, I don't rule that out. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but that may be the case. And but at the moment, I mean, the Tories think that if they can remind voters that Labour was in charge when everything went wrong in the financial sector, that is a big way of undermining Labour's current lead in the opinion polls. And the Tories are beginning to be afraid that the next general election is not going to be winnable by them. So, there are quite big, high political stakes here. I mean, I think just on what Seamus is saying, can I just come back on one point, which is, I mean, I think the real issue now is whether the legislation that's arisen out of the Vickers inquiry is strengthened or how they go beyond that. And I mean, the crucial question is really the separation of banking, some sort of Glass-Steagall legislation in this country. And I think that is really...
Which is the banks we all use as against the banks the people gamble with.
Yes, and, in which the executives and of the... Of those banks were personally liable rather than the taxpayer having any liability. I mean, if they go to the wall, they go to the wall, but we don't have to come in and deprive public sector of investment in order to rescue the banks. So I think that's a really really crucial question, and whether we get there depends on events in the next few months.
And thus far, Heather, the bill the government's proposing to take through
is actually a watered-down version of the Vickers report, wasn't it, in terms of how much money banks should have to set aside for a rainy day and all of that.
I think Martin's right. I think that one of the interesting things about this week is that it puts back on the table radical options that the government had ruled out. So Osborne hoped, you know, bank sort of re-regulation, as it were, was one of the key issues in the coalition discussions. We all knew that Vince Cable, the business secretary, was one of the things he was extremely concerned about. He was one of the voices warning that the banks were out of control in the run-up to the crisis. And the Chancellor hoped that by setting up this independent commission chaired by Sir John Vickers, he had closed this issue down. He dealt with it. And actually, politically, I think what's happened this week blows it right open again, because it's clear that if you follow this rather sort of careful forensic approach that Vickers has taken, you don't touch the kind of rotten culture that's been exposed by these emails and by what's going on here. It just leaves it completely untouched. And so, I think it does reopen that debate, which was one that I think the coalition hoped that they had closed down.
And I think it would be really interesting to know if Vince Cable is going to say anything big in the next few days. Because, I mean, to go back to Seamus's other point, I mean, you know, Cable was flirting at one point with the idea of state-financed banks in competition with the private banks on the high street, you know, so that you could, if you like, you know, put your salary into the bank, you know, the bank of government, the bank of Cable, rather than to Barclays or whatever. And, you know, that kind of idea, it doesn't go as far as what Seamus was talking about, but it's I think, again, on the table in a way that was not true.
Cable is a very interesting character in this saga because, exactly as Martin said, he leaked, or it was leaked, a letter by him earlier this year proposing that RBS or Lloyds be used as a fully owned, publicly owned state investment bank, which I think would be a very positive thing. And he has this reputation, as Heather has said, of having called the crisis right in advance. But actually, what he called correctly in advance was the levels of unsustainable private debt. He didn't really focus on the banks before the crisis. And he himself, which is something that reflects a wider problem of that time, also backed light touch regulation in the period of the boom. So the whole political class was tied up with a model, the light touch regulation model, not just New Labour in power, but the Tories who were pressing for even lighter touch regulation, and even someone like Vince Cable, something that has been seen to have failed and caused these horrific problem. So I think, you know, if there is an inquiry, and whatever form it takes, I don't think it's so damaging necessarily only for the Labour leadership. I mean, it's an entire political elite problem, which should come out in that debate.
Which is an interesting parallel with Leveson, I think, because, you could say, oh, Leveson's been devastating for the Tory party. It showed these incredibly close links with the Tories, but, you know, between the Tories and Murdoch. And actually, it's been devastating with the whole political class. You know, Jack Straw sitting on the train chatting away.
The media won't show anything like the degree of interest in a Leveson on banks, because it's not about the media. I mean, let's get real about it.
That's very true. Well, I shall be there, Martin.
This is on a day, of course, when the great temple to the gods that failed is being put up and opened in the city, funded by the Qataris. There's a laser show to celebrate the opening of the Shard today. But we'll leave the city there for now and let them go on celebrating about that. And just turn very briefly to Europe. First of all, Heather, week in, week out on this programme, we say Europe's knackered in one way or another and they've come up with a sticking plaster. It's going to come off straight away. Right at the beginning of the week, which seems a long time now, there were some signs that there'd been a bit of real movement by Germany and therefore a European deal that looked just a bit more meaningful.
That's right. I mean, it was as much of a shock as the Germany-Italy football game, I think. And people were talking about the two Super Marios, Mario Balotelli and Mario Monti, the Italian Prime Minister, because Italy and Spain, basically, I mean, with the help of François Hollande, who has changed the wind a little bit, ganged up on Germany and said, basically, we're not leaving this sort of all-night Brussels summit until you show a bit of flexibility. And at first sight, at least, it did look quite radical. So some of the moves, for example, that the Eurozone Rescue Fund, the European Stability Facility, stability mechanism. Sorry, there are so many of these acronyms.
No,
the ESM will be allowed to lend directly to banks. So that would mean that Spain and Italy would be able to have their banks rescued without having to go for a kind of full blown government bailout, which comes with, you know, incredibly stringent conditions, as we've seen for Greece and for Ireland and so on. So these look like quite significant moves. Having said that, in the way of these things, there seem to be a lot of caveats. So, for example, that is only expected to happen once a lot of progress has been made on a so-called banking union, so having a sort of centralised supervisor for the banks. A number of other countries, including Finland, for example, have since started to express a certain amount of nervousness about how this will work. So although the outlines of this deal look pretty impressive, as with so many of these things, it doesn't look quite as nailed down as it initially did on the morning after. So I think we'll have to see.
We'll have to see, but some very faint progress for the first time in a long time, Martin, in the right direction on the continent, and maybe or maybe not a sign of things to come. But as that was happening, David Cameron was making some interesting moves on Europe of his own, wasn't he, by talking about a referendum, maybe casting Britain.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, all the British political parties are very, very nervous about how the European issue is going to play out in domestic politics here over the next few years. And there's going to be a competition going on to be the first to propose the right form of referendum. Cameron got himself in a tangle over this question a week ago, but clearly the question of Britain's relationship with Europe is going to be a centrepiece of his party conference speech in the autumn. It's obviously going to be very important, and he's trying to he'll be setting up the question of what the Tories will be saying about a referendum on Europe in 2015. But Labour's in this game too, and Labour's flirting with that as well. So because particularly the Tories are very worried that UKIP is the coming force in British electoral politics. They are seriously concerned that UKIP will do very well in the European elections in 2014. This may not be of any interest to most people listening at this point, but the Tories are very seriously concerned about it because they foresee, and you can imagine it, that UKIP and Labour will both defeat the Tories in 2014. And with only 12 months to go before the general election, that puts a lot of pressure on all Tory MPs. I would just say one other thing, however, just goes back to what Heather has just been talking about and what you were asking her about Germany. What I think happened in Germany, the move of the German government a week ago on all this, I think makes it much more likely that that within a year's time there's going to be another grand coalition in Germany between the CSU, Merkel's party, and the Social Democrats. And I think if that happens, you know, the Social Democrats are not going to want Labour to start getting Britain out of the EU and generally playing that card. I think there's going to be a lot of very interesting politics going on across Europe over the next few months on these kind of issues.
So, Seamus, where is Labour? It seems that you get this sense that lots of them would like to offer a referendum and have cut round the Tories and be the ones to do it first. But the truth is, no one knows what they want a referendum on, because we don't even know what the European Union's going to look like in a year or two, do we?
Well, even David Cameron clearly doesn't. I mean, he's promising a referendum, maybe or maybe not, or maybe it'll be a vote in the general election, or maybe it'll be about in-out, or maybe it'll be about a renegotiated package before or after. So, I mean, the whole thing is slightly ludicrous. But, I mean, I think the Labour leadership is right to be looking for this opening, because I mean, it's a basic democratic question, and it would.
But what's the question?
It would enable the parties to start. I mean, the Labour Party to try and shift the debate on Europe away from the kind of UKIP style free market approach to the. To the issue. But exactly, so the question is, what is the question?
And on that bombshell, we will draw Politics Weekly to a close. So you can follow more on the questions about the questions at guardian.co.uk politics. In the meantime, my thanks to Martin Kettle, to Seamus Milne and Heather Stewart, and as well as Jill Traynor, who we heard from earlier. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much indeed for listening. Shine on, shine on, give praise, praise.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.